Sports Radio 1290. CFRW, Winnipeg.
Yeah! Time to get a lift.
A division of Bell Media.
Sports Radio 1290 presents the summer edition of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 2 hours of in-depth analysis, insight, and opinion into Canada's game.
Just a quick shot. Score! Just like that.
Now, here's Drew, Richard, and Ezra.
Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba, and for all those joining us live this evening at www.sportsradio1290.com, good evening, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my good friends Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. Michael Remus and the R-Desk are away tonight. He's away on assignment, the assignment being go to Lollapalooza in Chicago. Gentlemen, Richard, Ezra, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. There was a lot of Winnipeg Free Press that just stepped out. Timmy Campbell, Gary Lawless. It's great to be here, Drew. This is a big show, obviously, because it's the first time that you're ever going to promote deli meat eating on the show. I'm really excited. I brought a bib,
and we'll talk about that as we go on through the show. Richie, how are you this afternoon?
This evening, Drew.
This afternoon. It's so beautiful out. I'm willing to still call it the afternoon.
I'm doing well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. You're looking well.
Oh, thanks, Drew.
Okay, you know, I always like to throw you a little bit of a compliment before I throw you under the bus later on.
Very kind of you.
I try to do what I can. Big show in store for you this evening coming up in just a couple of minutes. Producer Adam is working hard to get him on the phone right now. Jesse Rogers from ESPN Chicago is going to join us.
Yep.
Patrick Sharp signed a big new contract in Chicago yesterday. So we're going to talk to Jesse about that new contract, get a little bit of an update on the offseason, all things Blackhawks related. And then coming up at 6:45, this evening from the Tennessean, Joshua Cooper is going to join us. Shea Weber went to arbitration with the Predators. To no one's real surprise, Shea Weber won that arbitration and is now an even wealthier man, 1 year, $7.5 million wealthier. So we're going to talk to Josh Cooper about that coming up in about 45 minutes' time. So big show in store. We'll take some of your calls throughout the show. We'll talk some Jets. Quiet on the Jets front this week for the most part, but we'll still find some things to bandy about. You two had a good head-to-head, so we'll talk that later on. And Timmy, you ready to go to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline?
Sure.
Okay, let's go there.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
And let's welcome to the program shortly after 6 o'clock, Jesse Rogers from ESPNChicago.com. Jesse, good evening and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Appreciate you giving of your time as always, Jesse. Thanks very much. Jesse, let's start with the Patrick Sharp, a new contract, 5 years, $29 million, if I'm not mistaken. Are you surprised at the average annual value, the salary cap hit that Sharp is going to be receiving?
I mean, not really. I mean, it could have gone a couple hundred thousand either way. I don't think it would have gone much higher than that. Kane and Taves make 6.3, so I don't think he's going to go over that threshold. So could have been a little bit lower, yeah. But, you know, the guy is an all-purpose player, and he's an all-purpose guy in terms of a Chicago mainstay. So you give him a little extra for that. You know, could they have gotten away with $5.5 million? Who knows? But the bottom line is he was a $5 to $6 million player. He got the upper limit of that. He's simply a do-it-all player and a do-it-all sort of guy off the ice. They're paying for it.
Jesse, you mentioned the contracts of Patrick Kane and Jonathan Toews both making $6.3 million. Do you think it was, you know, you mentioned the fact that that Sharp wasn't going to sign for over that amount. It seemed kind of a similar negotiation to that of Bobby Ryan and Anaheim in that, you know, Ryan was negotiating, but it didn't seem like Anaheim wanted to go over the Getzlaff or Perry contracts. Can you maybe draw some parallels between those two negotiations?
Well, maybe. I think it's you know, the Hawks' core is all locked up, and it's all kind of similar money. Now, it all depends on when you sign. Sometimes you're going to get more, sometimes you're going to get less. The Hawks happen to finally have some cap room, so maybe Sharp gets the upper limit there in terms of, you know, what he deserved. Other guys might get a little bit lower. You know, but if you look at Keith, Seabrook, Kane, Taves, they're all in the same range. Now, the hits are a little different in a sense because of the years and stuff, but they're all getting paid handsomely from $5 to $7 to $7.5 million, and I just think that, you know, Sharp fits right there. I don't know if you want to draw the comparisons to those other guys. It just makes sense. He's not going to be the number one or two guy paid on the team, but he certainly doesn't deserve to be the number, you know, 15 or 16 guy. He's a middle core elite player on the Hawks, and it just sort of made sense. And again, they probably gave him the upper limit for a lot of reasons, the tangibles, wearing the A and all that stuff. So, you know, every team has its own, you know, sort of situation. I think the Hawks simply saw their core and said, okay, whether it's $5 million, $5.5 million, $5.9 million, $6.3 million, you know, we're going to slot these guys where they, where we think they deserve, and maybe give them a couple $100,000 accordingly, you know, more or less, depending on how they feel about them, you know, in the big picture.
Jesse, can you give us a health update on Patrick Kane and let us know if he's going to be ready for the start of the regular season?
You know, I haven't heard much since the surgery. Now, the surgery was successful. He's back in Buffalo, as far as I know, rehabbing it. Now, there's probably not a lot he can do other than give it some time. So I don't have an updated timetable for him. We're still, what, about 6 weeks away, maybe 5 weeks away from training camp, so still quite a ways. I would imagine we'd get a better idea about him later this month. I haven't heard anything in terms of a setback, so right around training camp still seems to be what they're thinking.
Jesse, one of the sort of under-the-radar signings that just took place in the last couple of weeks was the Blackhawks signing of Ray Emery, ostensibly to come in and compete against Alex Salek for the backup job. Does the team sort of hope that Emery can grab that job, or are they just as comfortable going with Salek as the backup?
No, I think they want Salek, or Salak, depending on how you pronounce it. I think they want him to win it. I mean, if you look at the numbers, and people have been asking me this since they signed Emery, Emery's on a tryout. The other guy's on a one-way contract. I mean, who do you think they want to win the job? They don't want to pay the guy that's on the one-way $600,000 to play in the minors, although they won't have to pay Emery much to play in the NHL. But I think in the best of worlds, Salak wins the job. Emery signs a two-way contract and goes to the minors and is ready to be called up if Salak or Corey Crawford, for that matter, falters. I'm not sure if Emery would take that. It all depends on what other teams are looking at when he, you know, at the end of training camp. He has to be signed by October 1st, so basically at the end of training camp. But I would think the team wants the guy with the one-way contract to win the job.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we're joined by Jesse Rogers from ESPNChicago.com.
Now, Jesse, some teams look to have some kind of cap flexibility down the road, but I guess some teams also don't have the kind of talent that Chicago does. You mentioned on Twitter before, this team has Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Marian Hossa, Patrick Sharp, Brent Seabrook, Duncan Keith, and Steve Mondor signed through the 2014-2015 season. Do you see that as only being a positive thing?
You know, I've been asked that a couple times as well lately, and I mean, 90% of me says yes, it's a positive thing. There's that little nugget that if somebody, you know, goes poor, goes south quickly, and you're stuck with them for 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, in Duncan Keith's case or Marian Hossa's case, then you start to worry. But those guys are so young and so good that, and you know, character-wise, I believe they're pretty top-notch. I don't think you worry too much about it. Now, the other issue is injuries, and as you get older, they catch up with you, and that's certainly Marian Hossa's case. Listen, any of these guys that are signed to 10-year deals, they will be hard to live up to in years 7, 8, 9, and 10. Nobody can predict what Hossa's going to look like or Duncan Keith is going to look like a decade from now. So there's the downside. Rarely do those long-term contracts pay out in the back end. However, they do allow you some flexibility because the cap hit is so much lower with those long-term deals. Now you can make a better team around those guys. So you're going to have to give somewhere in the salary cap era. The Hawks will give late in maybe, you know, the head coach, the GM, the president. None of them might not be around when Hossa's deal is up. They may not have to worry about it. But at some point, those deals do catch up with you. Right now, they're bonuses because they lower the cap hits, and these guys are all young enough and good enough that you don't worry about them sort of, you know, going bad. In other sports, maybe you do, but I mean, a good hockey player is a good hockey player if they're backed up with some character. I think most of these guys are.
Kevin Cheveldayoff and Craig Heisinger interviewed Mike Haviland for the head coaching position here. Do you know how close Haviland was to being hired as the Jets head coach?
Yeah, I think it was pretty close. I think, you know, Cheveldayoff is, you know, sort of new to the Hawks organization the last couple of years, and he had a chance to see Haviland run the ship when Joe Quenneville was ill last year. Joe Quenneville had basically an ulcer from taking too much aspirin and over the years, not anything about a bad game or anything like that. But so Haviland took over and really impressed me, and I would assume he impressed the front office as well. Now, you never know. Cheveldayoff has, you know, all these ties with the Jets ownership going way back, and you know, there's always tentacles and ties to guys. So you just don't know how close Haviland was, but But I think he impressed Cheveldae off this year, this past season in particular, when he took over for Quinville. I think they went 3-4-1, and it was just his demeanor and the way he held himself that I think impressed everybody. Now, he was a head coach in the minors for several years, so it's not like it was new to Haviland to be the head man. But at the NHL level, it is a little different, and I do believe he was pretty close.
Jesse, you know, obviously the ties between the two organizations, the Blackhawks organizations and the Jets organization, is best exemplified by Kevin Cheveldayoff, his new role as the GM here. You know, you're familiar with his work in Chicago. What role was he sort of in charge of in Chicago? And, you know, how would you sort of grade his performance while in Chicago?
I think it was very good. I mean, I've known him for a long time with the Wolves. I mean, he was the GM there. They won many divisions and titles under his stewardship. In terms of the Hawks, it may have been a little different than most GMs and assistant GMs, because Stan Bowman was very good at the whole salary cap thing, and that's usually what the assistant GMs do. So I think he was instrumental in player evaluation as well. I think it was more than just, you know, running the numbers on the calculator. I think he knew his stuff when it came to the players, and certainly players coming up from the A, where he was the GM for so many years. So I think, as I used that word before, I think his tentacles sort of spread out everywhere, and it wasn't just one thing where, you know, some teams you have the assistant GM just running that calculator for the salary cap, and that's a full-time job in itself. I think Cheveldayoff had his hand in a lot of things, and that certainly prepares a guy for the head job, the head manager job at some point, and obviously he gets the job there in Winnipeg. So I think he's pretty well prepared, because he had a lot of duties with the Blackhawks, including plenty of player evaluation and dealing with some trades as well. I think he was instrumental in some things with the old Atlanta team, because he was the GM of the Wolves and knew the prospects and knew Jeremy Morin and these guys. So I think it was a unique relationship there with Atlanta and Chicago, and the fact that Cheveldayoff was there allowed them to move Bufflin and Ladd and all these guys, and certainly made an easier transition during that salary cap purge last summer. So he was instrumental, no doubt.
Jesse Rogers of ESPNChicago.com, thanks very much for joining us this evening on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
All right, guys, anytime. Take care.
Thanks, Jesse. Appreciate it. That was Jesse Rogers, as I just said. Always great insight into the Blackhawks organization. And, I mean, the two teams are tied together. I mean, you know, Jonathan Toews, of course, is a Winnipeg, Winnipeg boy. Everybody knows that. Patrick Sharp's got Winnipeg roots. You know, I believe he was actually born here.
Yes, he was.
From Thunder Bay is where he grew up.
Same
with
Duncan Keith.
Yeah, born here. Duncan Keith, Winnipeg,
born here, raised in
BC. So a lot of ties between the two organizations, especially, Kevin Cheveldayoff. They almost hired Mike Haviland, as Jesse just said.
Andrew Burnett just signed there for a one-year, $2 million deal. Switched agents in the summer to Don Baisley, Winnipeg agent. So, I mean, there's lots of ties in many respects. The most interesting thing to me, Drew, ties aside from the Winnipeg-Chicago relationship, is the Chicago cap situation. I think teams should model themselves after that, because what they're doing is they're locking up. I mean, when you look at it, they've locked up four guys through the next 4 years. Those four guys are Patrick Kane, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Sharp, and Marian Hossa. Four All-Stars is.
That's right.
And then aside from Steve Monador, which is a contract I really don't understand, but, you know, he's a solid, I think, 5-6 defenseman. I think he's getting paid. I think Leddy will hop over him, and it'll probably be a 5-6. Aside from him, you have Seabrook and Keith. So you have your best two defensemen, your best four forwards locked up with big money. That's what you do. You pay your best players. You fill out the rest of the roster. You can find Andrew Burnett on the free agent wire, but you can find a Patrick Sharp on the free agent wire, because they get signed before that.
Especially because a guy like Andrew Burnett is gonna seek out a team like Chicago to want to play for him. You know, I'll take
great fit.
He probably could have taken more money or longer term somewhere else, but he wants to be. You know, he's at the end of his career, probably getting close to it.
He's 38, I think.
So he certainly wants to. He wants to win. You know, and he'll play. He'll take $2 million. He'll go play. You know, the role he'll play on Chicago. I mean, he still can contribute offensively pretty nicely. You know, for $2 million, it's not a big salary situation. There's no such thing as a bad 1 year deal. And Andrew Burnett's probably thinking, hey, I get to play with all stars. It's a great situation for him.
And they got rid of the albatross.
I mean,
they got rid of it.
You have to thank the Florida Panthers for that. I mean, thank God that the Florida Panthers were $80 million below the salary floor.
You can thank Dale Talon for signing that contract, and you can thank Dale Talon for taking that contract when he went to
Florida. Yeah, it's funny how that worked, eh?
Yeah, well, you might as well compound your mistake a couple times.
There's only one person who thought that Brian Campbell was worth that much, although there was bidding for him in that time. And I think Dale Talon was the one person who ended up acquiring him twice for that price.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, whatever. Thanks. The Blackhawks thank Dale Talon for that. Yeah. Let's go. to break.
And a Stanley Cup.
Of course, and a Stanley Cup. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to talk some Jets stuff. Well, maybe we'll take some calls. We'll see. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on Sports Radio 1290. Good evening and welcome back. I am Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. The website is www.illegalcurve.com and facebook.com/illegalcurve. No R desk tonight, so I'm afraid there's no live chat tonight. Michael Remus is out in Chicago. I guess we gave him, did we actually give him a week off? Did we approve this, or is this an excuse?
It's not a paid vacation. It's an unpaid vacation.
Oh, it's okay. So he's
using all of his vacation days up right now.
Yeah, okay. That's one, apparently, right? Let's shift over to a little bit of Jets talk. Very quiet week on the Jets front.
I think the quietest it's been since the draft, I would say, or even May 31st.
No, quietest since, I don't think there hasn't been a week. There wasn't one conference call this week, I don't believe. So
that you were on asking questions.
That's how I judge it. If they have news that's worthy of a conference call, then it's a busy week. And if there's no news, there's no conference call.
Drew, I heard that Scott Brown was actually going to just put together a conference call just so you could be
so
one.
I can chat.
Yeah, there was no
so
news.
Chat with
he just wanted to,
just you
no,
and him
to
and,
have one.
Yeah, no, you him and a deadline.
I don't believe that was correct. But let's talk about Nikolaj Zverev. We talked about it last week. We sort of agreed that we thought there might have been a spot for him, or we could see how it would make sense, at least.
In theory, I think you guys all agreed that we didn't think it would happen based on what they've done so far.
Character but being their...
In theory, yeah, it made sense. Now, in practice, we didn't think it would happen.
And it didn't. Yeah. I mean, do you think is this a missed opportunity? Do you think this is a missed opportunity for the Jets?
Richie, I kind of got the impression that Zverev wanted to go to the KHL the entire time.
No, I don't think so, Ezzy.
I think he wanted to play here.
He went for the money.
Yeah, I guess we don't know what was being offered, but it seemed to me that he was maybe not wanting to go the entire time, but leaning, that was maybe number one. I could be wrong about that, but as far as being a missed opportunity, I think so. I mean, we were talking about this a week ago that, you know, it was maybe a little bit unlikely that the Jets were going to sign him based on some of his deficiencies, but, I mean, he would arguably be, a top six, top three forward on the team, and he could provide them with a goal-scoring bunch.
Bunch. It's okay.
And the thing is,
a bunch of goals.
That's the one thing that they need to do, aside from re-signing Bogosian, is still getting a top six forward. And it's not like they're going to bring in a $6 million guy. So they're going to be looking at guys similar age, similar cap hit, so it could be a missed opportunity in that sense.
Yeah, you know, I think it wasn't so much a missed opportunity in signing this guy and keeping him long term as much as I think it might have been a missed opportunity in signing him and trading him. Because I think he probably would have produced if he was given enough minutes and they could have dealt him off. Now, what was he worth? Well, I don't know, but I'm assuming if he was scoring quite well and the team really needed him down the stretch, he would have been worth something fairly substantial.
So you spoke about this last week. Just to reiterate, what you were saying, what you would have suggested is that they sign him for $1 million, a one-year, $1 million contract, something in that vicinity, and then get what you can get for him. And if he outperforms the contract, you trade him and you get a draft pick as an asset back.
You'd probably be able to trade him even if he doesn't outperform the contract, but you could trade him for more if he could outperform the contract.
Sticking with the Chicago Blackhawks, last week Richie mentioned that, you know, you sign a guy like John Madden who's still a free agent, and then a team like Tampa Bay wants him. I'm going to get to the Chicago connection. But you sign a guy like Zverev, and then you're out of the playoffs, and a team like Chicago is looking to bolster their scoring. They offer you a draft pick for Zverev, so it's a similar situation. So
yeah, exactly.
They have to be considering. I don't know how interested they are in a guy like Corey Stillman or John Madden or Mike Greer. I have no idea, but it's the same type of situation. Your deal.
I believe by law, if you sign Corey Stillman after 60 games, you have to trade him to Carolina. I believe that's a law.
Let's check this, but he's probably been traded to Carolina three times, I think.
Well, he was way back in the day. He was, Calgary, then St. Louis, then Tampa, then Carolina, then St. Louis, then Carolina, then Ottawa.
Florida, you're forgetting, I think.
Here, I'll look it up right now. I'll see what I can find. He's certainly been in Carolina a number of different times.
At least twice. But, again, there's merit to, I think, all those points. We talked about Brian Rolston before. He was traded. Look what he was traded for, guys. He was traded for Trent Hunter, who was bought out.
Yep.
So the Devils were able to get from under the Rolston contract.
Yeah. And they took a cap. They take a cap hit. I'm checking right now. Capgeek.com is obviously a great resource for information like this, and we're utilizing it right now. Mm-hmm. When you look at the New Jersey Devils, what they did was they traded Brian Rolston's $5 million cap hit for next season to New Jersey, and they got Trent Hunter, who had $2 million per year left on a two-year deal. Now, Trent Hunter counts against the cap for $666,000 for the next 4 years.
It's a bad number.
The question is this, though. I mean, it's not, you know, it's in a cap world with big contracts and with Zach Parise coming up again next year as a UFA. That's not an insignificant number. You know, what was it worth to them? Maybe if they would have given a third round pick, you know, that's a question I put out last week, and we've talked about on the show before. If say it was a third or second round pick, and they traded him to Winnipeg just to take the $5 million, just to not have $666,000 for the next 4 years against your cap,
yeah,
maybe it was worth it to them. Did they talk about it? I don't know, but it's just something that comes to mind in terms of creating value as a team that has cap space and is rebuilding.
Yeah,
you know, on the topic of the Devils. I wasn't surprised that, you guys know I'm a huge Colin White fan. I wasn't surprised that they bought him out. His play has gotten worse, and he was making a lot of money. I wasn't surprised by that. I was a little bit surprised by them buying Trent Hunter out. I actually think that they could use him, but they actually essentially bought out Rolston in a way because they got rid of a $5 million contract. For a $2 million contract.
But yes, look at that. Look at the
buyout. But they did it very cheaply, though, because, like you said, the cap hit was... $2.75 million, but it was interesting how they bought him out. What, 3 days after they traded for him,
right? Because they traded for a lower buyout. But
yep,
the point is this though, as because of course how it works is you're paying out like if it's a 2 year contract, which Hunter was, you're paying out over 4 years, which
right.
They're doing.
You get
New Jersey Devils talking about mismanagement since the salary cap came into play after the lockout. Now, Lou Lamoriello's inability to really seem to manage it. On a year-by-year, month-by-month, never mind year-by-year basis, this year they have cap hit of 2.66 for buyouts for players.
You don't want dead money on your roster. Any dead money you have on your roster is preventing you from going out and either signing a player or acquiring a player.
Zubras has got to be next. How many years does he have left? Does he have 1 year, 2 years? If he has 2 years, I wouldn't be surprised if he was the next guy. The Devils made terrible contract decisions. It started with Malikov and McGillney back in, 6 years ago? And Lamoriello actually did a good job of getting rid of two contracts, White and Rolston. The guys that everyone was criticizing last year, remember when the Devils started 10-29-2 or whatever it was?
But is the Devils' defense good enough that you can get rid of Colin White?
Absolutely not. It's not a good defense. And what,
so aren't there better candidates on that roster for a buyout?
What people are saying is that, and we had Tom Giulitti on, was it 2 weeks ago on the show, and we asked him about Adam Larson. And Adam Larson is the future of that team. I mean, he's 18 years old. Yeah. It's too early to predict how good he'll be. But people are saying, well, they used the extra salary for Larson. I don't think he has any bonuses in his contract.
All those guys do.
No bonuses.
No bonuses?
No, that's the whole thing.
Lamoriello doesn't sign guys to bonuses, and that was the whole issue.
If you look at the bonuses and what are available for defensemen, you likely wouldn't have achieved.
I was going to say, if you're a defenseman, when was the last time a rookie defenseman would have made his bonus mark?
Definitely not Victor Hedman.
I'm assuming Fanuff hit all of his bonuses.
As a rookie defenseman?
Yeah,
it's pretty rare.
But, I mean, it's rare that they actually come into the league and do anything in the score sheet.
Yep.
But that's just my we've spoken before about how poorly managed New Jersey's been since the.
What about the signing for San Jose?
Well, I want to talk about that next because they also signed Brent Burns.
Yes.
So which they had to do after acquiring him.
They had to, and I wrote that on my Twitter. You had to do that because you just traded three first rounders, but a first rounder that's now Charlie Coyle and a first rounder this year. You get a second back, and you get Burns. Burns is an all-world defenseman, but he's a pending UFA. You couldn't trade all that haul for a year of Burns. You had to sign him. You had to, you know, you could have argued that they maybe should have let him play a few games to see how he fit in, but the talent-wise, he's just such an incredible player that he should fit in quite fine. My only concern with him, we'll talk about it next segment.
We'll talk about it next segment.
I want to quickly talk, Drew, about Colin White and the role he has, and I think what happened was, you know, Colin White was the leading penalty killer last year in terms of ice time for the New Jersey Devils.
Doesn't he's been a main... Sorry, I'll cut you off and then let you continue.
Yeah.
Colin White is one of those, like, classic old-school hockey players. I think that's what I wrote on the site. Mm-hmm. And he's not... I don't know how many career goals he has, maybe 20 or something off the top of my head. But he's the type of guy that he's been a mainstay on the Devils' yes. defense. He used to play with Niedermeyer, and he was, like you said, Richie, I'll let you continue, but always out there for penalty killing, and he was a big physical defenseman. He was valuable to the Devils.
And we'll talk about the San Jose effect in the next segment. But, you know, as I think maybe what it is they want to increase a little bit of more of Talander and Volchenkov's responsibility, and they feel like guys like Andy Green and a guy like Salvador, if healthy, can fill those roles. And, of course, Larson's offensive player. The other guys are more defensive players. So maybe they thought they had too many defensive players on the roster. The truth is, aside from Larson, who's not supposed to be the most amazingly offensively gifted player, it's really an Andy Green and bust in terms of offense on the back end in New Jersey. So when you're looking at Salvador...
He's had problems. That's what worries me about that.
You look at Volchenkov, you look at Talander, they're all three your stay-at-home defensemen. So how many stay-at-home defensemen do you need? Essentially, what teams like to do, for the most part, is they like to play an offensive defenseman with a defensive defenseman. Yeah, you see it they bounce off each other's weaknesses and strengths.
Well, like I just said, White, back in the day, Niedermeyer and White.
Exactly.
Niedermeyer could do that because White was a stay-at-home defenseman, and he would never take any risks.
You look at all teams for the most part. You know, you generally see Keith play with Seabrook. Seabrook's more defensive defenseman, although he obviously has offensive skills. Keith likes to join the rush a lot. You look at Chicago last year before the Campbell injuries. Campbell, offensive defenseman, takes the puck through the neutral zone pretty quickly, paired with Nicholas Chalmerson, defensive defenseman. And that's just the way teams work, and that's the way anybody who plays rec league hockey likes to work it. You don't want both of your gunslingers playing together and both of your stay-at-home guys because it spreads the ice out too much.
Fortunately for the Illegal Curve rec league team, we have no gunslingers whatsoever. And no defensive defenseman, so we're doing real well this year.
You're the gunslinger.
Yeah, I had 4 goals in a game.
Drew, we haven't talked about, though, forget the 4 goals in the game. We have a big birthday coming up here.
Here we go.
And we should mention, do we have a happy birthday song by the Beatles?
I'm sure we can find it for later
on. Well, Drew, why don't you tell the listeners what birthday it's coming up?
It's going to be my 30th birthday on Saturday. Well, Sunday is my actual birthday. Saturday is the celebration.
Now, Drew.
Yes.
I wasn't at hockey, but apparently you had quite a reaction when you announced this in the locker room.
Well, I mean, there was no announcement. I just told people that if they wanted to come out...
They were surprised that you were 30.
Who was surprised that I was 30?
Apparently people were surprised. That's what I heard.
They thought I was older? Is that what you're saying? They thought I was older?
Our listeners thought you were turning 40. Our friends thought you were turning 27 or 28.
Really? That's it?
I don't know. I'm just speculating.
Our friends are stupid. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on Sports Radio 1290. Am I sensing a pattern for the rest of the theme songs for the rest of the show? For the record, though, the hair comment applies to all three of us, regardless of our
age. That's true, Drew, but you know, some of our listeners may think you're turning 64, so we figured this would be fitting.
Okay, well, I'm not, so just for the record. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Still to come, coming up next segment, Joshua Cooper from the Tennessean in Nashville is going to join us, talk about Shea Weber's new contract.
You know, we're both Leos, Drew.
You and I, you mean?
You and I.
Yeah.
Having said that, let's continue.
Okay, thanks. Let's talk about San Jose. We mentioned it before the break. Let's talk about their season upcoming. You know, they signed Brent Burns to the after they acquired him at the trade deadline. Not the trade deadline. Nope. Pardon me, the draft.
Yeah. After Ezzy interviewed him.
Yeah, after Ezzy interviewed him, and then 5 minutes later, he was traded.
No, he was traded. I interviewed him the day after he was traded.
Well, obviously, you interviewed him, and the team just had to ship him out immediately because the stink of Ezzy was on him.
That's right.
You know, he's likely to tear three of his ACLs or something and walking down the stairs or something. He gets the big contract in San Jose. I mean, $5.76 million is the average annual hit for the next, you know, 5 years or so after this season. Is San Jose the front runner in the Western Conference right now?
I want to jump in here.
That's your job.
I think they are, and my apologies to the Minnesota Wild, but I think they won both of those trades, and I wanted to you know root for Minnesota and find a way that they won those trades, and I think the trades are better. For Minnesota as far as goal scoring because they need that. Obviously, Danny Heatley and Devin Sataguchi, you just took two of their top six goal scorers away. But Brent Burns, I think, is exactly what San Jose has needed. And I really like Martin Havlat getting traded, even though it was for Heatley. And, you know, Heatley, there was something missing there. He went through spurts. He never had any success in the playoffs. And we talked to Randy Hahn a few weeks ago, and he said that's how Danny Heatley's tenure in San Jose is going to be remembered. He had absolutely no success in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. So I think they are the front runner. You look at their defense, and I mean, it's arguably top three in the league. And I would say they are the front runner. I mean, I guess who else is there? I mean,
well, let's go through their defense.
It's Vancouver or San Jose, right?
Let's go through their defense. I mean, you know, Boyle and Burns. You know, that's a top-notch 1-2 pairing, or a top-notch.
They won't play together.
I know they won't play together. But top-notch 1-2. You know, defensemen. You know, they're both top. They're both top two defensemen.
Burns
right?
will likely play with Vlasic.
Right. Yep. You know, Vlasic and Murray. Both of them are young, but certainly talented.
Murray's what 20? He's got to be at least 27, 28 now.
Yeah, but I mean,
Murray's slow. Vlasic's fast. Murray's not a good puck mover, but he clears the front of the net. He can block shots. He can do the little things. Vlasic is a talented offensive player when given the opportunity and who needs to find his game a little bit more, but has a lot of potential.
Probably took a step back based on what we saw from him
two
years
ago. A little more a step forward near the end of this year, I think.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, he's certainly got a lot of talent.
Playing with Brent Burns is certainly a step up or two steps up from playing with Jason Demers.
Yeah. And then your bottom, three defensemen are Jason Demers, Jim Vandermeer, and Colin White.
Right. And then and most likely, Vandermeer is probably the worst out of those three. White is your 6'7" guy.
Yeah.
Demers is very young.
He can move the puck, though. So you're going to want
Demers.
But Ezzy, that's
a young, mobile defense core. What else can you ask for?
That goes to our point, though. Boyle, puck mover, good skater. Murray, stay-at-home defenseman.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, the second pairing, you have a little bit of both in that Vlasic, and Burns can both kind of rush the puck. But Burns is a more capable offensive player. And in the last pairing you mentioned, so Jason Demers is a right-handed shot. He played the fifth or sixth slot on the third pairing, and maybe second power play if they want to. If they need him, they have a lot of talent, especially if they play Pavelski on the point. But then on the left side, you have Colin White, defensive defenseman, or Jim Vandermeer. Both shoot left. Both can kill penalties. Both can block shots.
Both are professionals.
Can do the dirty things.
Both know what it takes to win in the league.
Right.
They'll do the dirty work exactly. The locker room influence that those guys will bring can't be. I mean, Colin White, how many rings did he win in New Jersey?
Sometimes you think that's overrated, but I think on that team, I think it's not overrated.
I think in a team like San Jose, they need a guy to walk in that dressing room who's going to show off the bling and says, this is what I want for this team.
Drew, forgetting Colin White for a second, when you look at Havlat, and Burns for Heatley and Setoguchi, you've lost some speed from Setoguchi, but Havlat is quicker than Setoguchi.
Quicker than Heatley, you mean?
Than Heatley.
Yeah. Agree on all.
And Setoguchi obviously was a forward for a defenseman trade. But you look at the speed that they've gained, Havlat is arguably a better player than Heatley. But
I think he is. Right now, I think he is. You could argue before whether he was or not. Heatley's taken a downward, his career's taken a downward turn. Now, can he get back up? Maybe, but he doesn't skate as well as he used to. He was never a great skater. You know, Havlat's a better stick handler. He's quicker. Like the puck on his stick. So this is why I think he won't play with Joe Thornton, but instead will play with another center, whether it be Pavelski or somebody else. I think that trade was at least a wash. I really do.
Yep.
And you mentioned it. So if you're calling that trade a wash, Setoguchi, is he irreplaceable? No. I mean, he's a good, very good player.
Yep.
But he also played a lot with Joe Thornton, and many players look very good with Joe Thornton.
Yeah.
Okay? And he's gone up and down the lineup. That guy started first line, went to the third line, came back up, played well in the playoffs. But Brent Burns, when healthy, is a difference maker on defense, and he's a better player than Devin Setoguchi, hence the Charlie Coyle in the first round pick being included.
Yep.
Also the second round pick, but you give up more for him.
And, and unfortunately,
you get a better player, you can give up more for him.
When we were at the draft, okay, I remember this very, very
vividly.
Very vividly, me and Kyle were waiting to interview Mike Babcock.
It's a great story, by the way.
There was a scrum around Mike Babcock at the draft, and the trade was announced, and everyone at the XL Energy Center booed it, obviously, because Brent Burns is a very popular player. And the trade was announced, and Mike Babcock walked away from who he was being interviewed by. We didn't get to interview him. And he looked upset. As far as I'm concerned, the Sharks gave up a lot to get Brent Burns.
Said a couple kind words, and then he looked upset. You can clarify as
Brent Burns,
he was frustrated.
26,
he sees one of his chief opponents get better.
Well, he's
I'd be aggravated
by
that too.
Brent Burns is in the prime of his career. He's now under contract for 6 years with San Jose. This guy, I mean, Brent Burns is not the flashiest guy, but if Team Canada at the 2010 Olympics or prior to the 2010 Olympics was considering him to make the team,
Babcock,
the best team in the world,
and Babcock was the guy who made the decision.
Okay, you think that's not going through his mind? He's thinking like, first off, Rafalski's retired. Detroit's taken a step back.
And they're older team. You're right.
And they're thinking San Jose is the, as far as I'm concerned, it's kind of like a, three or four horse race. Yeah, LA's gone better, but it's Vancouver, cool. Detroit, LA's San Jose.
But they're more concerned about San Jose because they've got lost them twice in a row in seven games.
Yeah, I mean right now they've kept their core together, but they've improved in the areas where they need to improve.
It's a five horse race, if you ask me. And you look at back to Setoguchi. Drew pulled up the stat. Setoguchi played almost a third of his ice time last year with Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau. I mean,
it's easy to look good when you're playing with those guys.
Not to say he's not a good player. I don't think he has 40-goal hands. I've always questioned Setoguchi's hands, not that he's not a capable scorer. I think he's more of a 20- to 25-goal scorer in Minnesota. Certainly a valuable commodity, great speed, can close gaps really quickly, can forecheck well. But I never loved his hands. And there's certain guys who play with Joe Thornton. You know, you've seen it before, Jonathan Chichu, Glenn Murray, right-handed shooting guys. Now, both of those players aren't fast like Setoguchi. But the point is that he makes players
look better than they actually are. He makes some people wealthy.
How about this, guys? If you allow me to take the role of host for 5 seconds, out of all of those out of those five teams that we named in the Western Conference, which one of those teams, aside from San Jose, improved? I would say that every single team either didn't improve.
L.A.?
Not including L.A.
Okay, yeah.
Vancouver, Detroit, Chicago. You could make an argument that Vancouver didn't improve.
They don't have Mason Raymond because he's a terrible back injury. Samuelson, I think, is still going to be out. And then Kessler. So they certainly haven't gotten any better.
Right. Okay.
So there's one.
Detroit. Rafalski. Draper done? Retired.
You're right. So they're not as good.
Made some
and
minor
Lidstrom's
signing.
A year older.
Lidstrom's a year older. Chicago made some minor moves. They're still in the mix.
Chicago is going to be right back up at the top.
Better on paper. They got a little. I like Burnett. I don't love Montador.
I think they retired last season, to be
perfectly
honest.
But they lost Campbell, so I don't know if they got any better. Drew, contract aside, Brian Campbell still makes a pass through the zone.
Yeah, no, he's still a good player.
That's... So talent-wise, I think you're right, Desi, so far. Keep going.
As far as I'm concerned, you know how I mean, I'm huge into LA right now, and I think they have a good chance at making a good run this year. Wait till our preseason show before we make
wait
the
announcement. Wait till they sign Drew Doughty, and then
Drew Doughty and Mike Richards, you're a better team.
I would say, back to the same point, I think San Jose is the favorite in the Western Conference. I think it's for me, it's unanimous.
And by the way, quickly, just before we go to break, Mark Chipman was on HNL this afternoon.
Great interview.
Yeah, and he was a great interview. And one portion of the interview I think would be something that our listeners would really want to hear is that he commented on the Zach Bogosian contract and said, you know, both sides are taking it as it comes. They really don't. There's nothing really, no real deadline right now. It sounded like the Jets may be waiting on like a Luke Shen kind of contract.
And just mimic it.
Mimic kind of thing. Now, Luke Shen is not as good of a skater as Zach Bogosian. He's not as good offensively as Zach Bogosian.
Same age, right? Both 08 draft picks.
Yes, same age, exactly. Yeah. Right-handed shooting defenseman. Pretty tough, so they might look, I think Bogosian's a superior guy. I don't think Shen will ever be better than a number four defenseman, really. He's a second pairing, right side defenseman to me. But it just gives people an idea of where the Bogosian talks are at right now.
Okay, well, thanks for bringing that up. That's a good point.
Maybe Toronto's waiting for Winnipeg, though.
Maybe them.
Somebody's going to eventually going to have to bite the bullet. Let's go to break. When we come back from the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, Joshua Cooper is going to join us. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on Sports Radio 1290.
In honor of Drew's birthday.
This is what I have to look forward to in life, I suppose. How do I get locked up with you guys?
Look at my life. I'm a lot like you were.
The big 3-0.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You guys are very humorous, I must say.
LOL.
LOL. Thanks. Yeah, that's a great sign. That's a great Curb Your Enthusiasm reference. Timmy, we ready to go to the Hockey Show hotline? Let's go there.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
And let's welcome back to the program from the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, Tennessee, Joshua Cooper. Welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks for having me on. And congrats to Winnipeg on the Jets coming back to town. I haven't been on since the news. Good news. And congrats on having the NHL team back in the peg.
Appreciate that, Josh. It's easy for you to say good news. I was checking the schedule to see when Nashville comes to Winnipeg this year.
Josh
and they're not. You guys, we come to see you in Nashville.
Right, right, exactly. I guess in the preseason, though, the Preds come up there.
Yeah,
but not regular season.
No, in September, there's only about 6 inches of snow on the ground, so you should be okay still then.
Awesome, awesome. That's like Nashville in the way. No, it never really snows here.
Well, I'm sure after this season, when we move to the West, I'm sure you'll get to experience a nice blast of winter every year or so.
Yeah, we might be in the same division.
Hot here.
Yeah.
Josh, it's probably about 35 degrees here right now.
Yeah, well, exactly. The problem is when it's 35 degrees in February and you're trying to make ice, that's where it gets to be a little bit tricky.
Good point.
Yeah. Josh, let's start with the Shea Weber arbitration hearing. He obviously won 1 year, $7.5 million. Are you surprised that the arbitrator came out with that amount, that dollar amount? I mean, it's not like baseball where you can either pick one number or the other number. The arbitrator can pick any number in between the two.
No, I'm not that surprised at all. I mean, you kind of look at kind of his measurables, who he stacks up against. I mean, he's being paid like one of the top defensemen in the NHL, and that's exactly what he is. He's one of the top three defensemen in the NHL, as recognized last year in terms of being the runner-up for the Norris Trophy. He's fifth in terms of real salary, and first in terms of salary cap hit. And, he's a tremendous player, does everything for Nashville, has intangibles to go along with his immense skill. And I'm not surprised at all at the ruling. More surprised the fact the Preds asked the arbitrator for $4.75 million. I know that's strategy, but still, captain probably couldn't have been too happy about that one.
Josh, you have to confirm this, but Ryan Suter is an unrestricted free agent next summer, right?
Correct.
So, two-part question. How does the Shea Weber signing affect that negotiation process, coming up next year? And What do you think is in the cards for Ryan Suter signing a long-term deal in Nashville?
I think it affects the negotiations tremendously. You have two defensemen drafted the same year. They're defense partners. Both are Olympians. Granted that Weber's got the Norris Trophy nod and he's got a little bit more support behind him, but, in terms of watching these guys every night this year, you couldn't really tell who was a better defenseman more consistently. Mm-hmm. One night one looked better, the other night the other looked better. In the Anaheim series, Shea Weber was the dominant force for Nashville on the blue line. In the Vancouver series, Ryan Suter was their best defenseman. So, it's tough to really say what this means. I mean, you have to think that Ryan Suter will now start using the $7.5 million award given to Shea Weber as a benchmark. And he's unrestricted, so he probably has a little more leverage than Shea Weber had. So, it will probably jack up the price a little bit for Ryan Suter, just considering the fact that it is a pretty hefty award.
Yeah, Predators fans certainly have to be nervous, Josh. Moving to the goaltending situation, and for years it was a combination of whether it be Chris Mason, and they moved through a number of Dan Ellis, through a bunch of guys. They really seem to have found a solid, big-time number one goaltender in Pekka Rinne. He's on the books for 3.4 this year, as you know, and he's a pending UFA as well. Is this... The Nashville likes to kind of be within a certain salary cap range, close to the middle, a little bit below the middle. Do you see Rinne maybe being a casualty in the efforts to sign Weber and Suter, or do they all kind of play together?
Yeah, some people kind of brought that up to me, and I think it just depends on the type of depth you have within your organization. Nashville clearly has a lot of defensive depth, so they could absorb some of the blow of losing Weber and Suter, but at the same time, you're talking about two highly elite defensemen. And it's pretty rare to have two guys like that on one team. You're talking about Rinne, and it's not obviously not to take anything away from Rinne. He's a tremendous hockey player. But at the same time with him, you have a guy like Lindback, who had a pretty nice winning record for the Predators when Rinne was out last year with his various injuries. It's tough to really say. He may end up being that, as you said, cap casualty for them just because of the kind of depth they have in their goaltending system. It's not just Anders Lindback. You have other guys in the minors like Chet Pickard and Jeremy Smith, and the goaltender they drafted this year in the second round, Magnus Hellberg. So they have a lot of depth in terms of defense and goaltending. In terms of NHL-ready depth, it's probably more so at goaltending.
We're joined on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show by Joshua Cooper of the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville. Now, Josh, the downside to the arbitration process is that Nashville and Shea Weber could be right back at it again next season.
But not by the team.
Not by the team, sorry, right. But you know, do you expect that they're going to have signed to a long-term deal before they revisit this again?
I think they want to, and I think he wants to sit as a long-term. I mean, everything I've heard about Shea Weber in Nashville from sources around the league is just he does love it here. He does like being here. He likes living here. He has a nice home here. It's just sort of a matter of Shea Weber also wants to win the Stanley Cup. And a lot of the players he played with on Team Canada when he was at the Olympics, a lot of them have played for the Stanley Cup since then. And even before then, they played for the Stanley Cup. So, you know, Shea Weber wants to win, and I think the Nashville needs to show him that they want to win. I mean, you kind of look at what happened in Columbus, same division. They go out and get James Wisniewski and Jeff Carter. And not that there's any issues with Rick Nash at all, but I'm sure Rick Nash is probably smiling at that. You know, the Predators have kind of yet to show this offseason that they're willing to go out there and make a significant addition to their forward court. David Poile talked about how he wants to add a top six forward. Shea Weber talked about how he wanted the Predators to add a top six forward. Nothing's been done yet. So, you know, I think that's the way he stays long term. They just have to show him basically that they're willing to make some of the financial sacrifices that come with being in a small market and get a bigger name in forward.
Josh, you mentioned top six forward and the fact that, you know, Shea Weber and GM David Poile have expressed interest in getting a top six forward. I think we've talked to you about the Predators wanting a top six forward five times before on this show. So when is it going to happen?
That's a good question. David Poile has said it's going to happen at the appropriate place and appropriate time. When that is, I don't know.
It's 5 years ago?
Yeah.
It could be at the trading deadline. It could be before the season. It's tough to really say. It just depends on when a top six comes on the market and what Nashville's willing to give up for him.
Josh, you know, David Poile gets a lot of credit for the job he's done since the team came to Nashville, and much of it is you know, absolutely due. One issue I have, and I've had mentioned on this show before, is, you know, the team seems to have really good cap management skills, except for when it comes to maybe retaining their own players or even bringing in Mike Fisher. Like, you look at the cap now, and they have, you know, almost just over $13 million locked up in Mike Fisher, David Legwand, and Martin Erat, none of which I think are top-line players. Is that one of the reasons is that one of the things that gets in the way of them bringing in players, the money they've locked up in maybe second and third liners?
Well, I don't think you can really fault them on Mike Fisher just because, I mean, he's a second liner, but he's almost a two-way in that. I mean, he's better than your average second liner. David Legwand, Martin Erat are slightly different in terms of that. I mean, Martin Erat will be making $6 million next year. That's obviously not a cap hit, but $4.5 million against the cap with him and David Legwand. And I think that part of it with them was just sort of the fear of them leaving and locking them up long term, and you lock them up based on potential. So, but at the other end of that spectrum, at the same time, you kind of look at the way free agency has gone this off season. Some of the big contracts that have been given out to players who probably don't deserve those contracts, but really set the market on them. And now that the Erat and Legwand deals aren't looking quite as bad. Maybe a year ago they did, but right now they don't look quite like they did about this time last year.
Josh, one other question. They're looking for a top six forward. It seems like one that they have Ryan Ellis in the system and Jonathan Blum, you know, all the top young defensemen they have in the system. But Colin Wilson, a guy who's kind of played on the fringe of the roster, got into some games, hasn't really played a significant role for a long period of time. Isn't he possibly the guy who has the top six skills, is under cost control, that could be that guy if given the opportunity?
Going on the radio in Winnipeg, I knew I was going to get a Colin Wilson question. yeah, you know, he's got the skill. He's got the body. He's, you know, got a lot of potential. Clearly a first-round pick and a pretty decent draft. You know, I mean, David Poile's talked about him and talked about Nick Spaulding as two guys who could be top sixes, and Colin Wilson. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see what happens with him this season, just because he was benched during the playoffs. You know, similar situation happened to Ryan Suter a few years ago, and Ryan Suter came back and was stronger, was more committed, looked better. And you gotta wonder if that's gonna happen with Colin Wilson here, because I mean, benched during the playoffs, and how will he come back? How will he respond? I think Nashville is interested to see how that happens, and if he does respond and come back and be the type of player he was at Boston University, and when he was at Milwaukee, then I think that, you know, it'll he could fill that void.
Joshua, last question here. You look at the roster, and we've talked about the pending RFAs and the pending UFAs and everything else. Right now, and for the years, the Predators have sort of been a middle-of-the-road salary cap team. Is there any internal discussion to the fact that maybe, in order to keep everybody and add so that the team can make a longer run into the playoffs, they might have to spend a little bit more salary cap-wise?
Yeah, this is the thing that I've been talking about the last few days is, very rarely do sports teams operate at a profit. Sports teams often operate at a loss, and you really need to spend money to win and be okay with operating at a loss. What will Nashville do? Tough to really say, but in order to win, I think they do need to lock these guys up and maybe add another top six forward in the salary range of maybe $4 to $5 million or even $6 million. I think that they have the cap space, and I think that they understand they have to win, but maybe the time has come for them to loosen the purse strings a little bit.
Josh Cooper of the Tennessean in Nashville, thanks very much for joining us this evening on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
No worries. Anytime, guys.
Thanks Josh. Take care. That's Josh Cooper. Great insight into the salary dealings of the Nashville Predators. Always on the cusp, but not ever able to get over that next hurdle.
Yeah, always lacking the offensive punch to take it to the next level.
We've been talking about it for years.
They lost to Josh Cooper mentioned this on his blog. He's got a great blog. Everybody should read him because he does a great job.
He was
the guy covering the Shea Weber arbitration hearing.
Yeah.
They lost to Vancouver, who is the guy that really beat them single-handedly, Ryan Kessler. Uh-huh. And the Sedins were all right in that series. That was probably their best series. But they need more offense. They have two of the best defensemen in the league. You could argue top two are the best in the league. If you don't add 35 goals and 70 points to that roster,
doesn't matter.
It's not going to do anything.
Get into the playoffs, but you don't go anywhere.
They need to take the next step, and it's a good point. It's a good question that you asked, Drew. They probably should consider spending $4 or $5 million over the cap, take the loss. I mean, thankfully, we're not owners of sports teams.
Yeah, but they're going to have to spend some money eventually. Unfortunately, I mean, at some point in time, they haven't been able to develop that top six forward really on their own. So maybe they have to dip into the free agency to get them. I know it's not the way they go about it typically, but it might be time for them to do so. Of course, when it's not my money, it's easier said than done. Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more Jet stuff. We're going to go talk about the New York Rangers getting Brandon Dubinsky and Ryan Callahan, and we're getting close to this official sandwich hour.
When's the sandwich? What'd you taste?
7:30. We're going to start with a little bit of some sandwich talking around 7:30.
Nice.
So stay tuned for that. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on Sports Radio 1290.